Are we exposed? Security teams ask this every day. Vulnerabilities across network, cloud, AI, and OT silos hide the truth, and attackers are watching. Tenable unifies your tools, teams, and data so you can spot and close risks fast. Tenable's AI-powered exposure management gives teams one view of risk, helping them focus, take action, and close critical exposures fast. Visit Tenable.com. Tenable. Your exposure ends here.
I'm John Batchelor with Professor Jonathan Healy, whose wonderful new book is filled with stories and imaginary moments that we now can visit from the 21st century and say, so that's where John Locke came from. That's where an understanding of government representing the people came from. And that's where trouble comes from when a man, James II, the younger brother of Charles II, decides somewhere in the 1660s to convert to Catholicism, perhaps surrounded by Catholics on the mainland, knowing that if he was ever to ascend to the throne, this would introduce contretemps again into his native land. Well, here it is. The moment that we can anticipate, there's rumors that James is converted, but with the death of his brother, this is in the 1680s, the death of his brother, James I becomes the King of England. And he's been leader of the fleet. He's had charge. He's a very good warrior, very good combat leader. But he resigns from the Navy because he won't swear. He won't take an oath that would reveal that that would violate his Catholicism. And Jonathan, I come to this because James II is a less well-known figure, Charles II, the Restoration. James II had to know he was introducing trouble. Did he believe, knowing all of that, knowing how few Catholics there were in the country, that he could be successful? He wasn't preaching tolerance. He was switching out Protestants for Catholics in important roles.
It's a very good question. I don't think we'll ever know the answer to that. He probably believed that the monarchy by that point was in enough of a strong position because of the financial strength that it had, that it could basically do what it wanted. And I think what he underestimated was the, not only the kind of anti-Catholicism, but also the sort of parliamentary constitutionalism, which by this point had become much more ingrained, I think. And a lot of the things that go wrong with James II's reign are not necessarily to do with his Catholicism as such. They are to do with the way that Catholicism problematizes his relationship with Parliament. But actually, I think to understand James II, we need to take a step back to the moment at the end of Charles II, his brother's reign, when it becomes clear that James is then Duke of York. It becomes clear that James is a Catholic. And in Parliament, there is a movement to exclude him from the throne. So Parliament basically passes an act, or the idea is that Parliament will pass an act and the act will change the succession to the throne. Now, out of this comes two things that we've not really seen in England at this point before, which are political parties, obviously still with us today. At this point, the Whigs and the Tories. The Whigs believe that Parliament has the power to change the succession. The Tories believe that it doesn't. And they both have religious connotations as well. The Whigs are more are anti-Catholic and they're more sympathetic to dissent, Protestant dissent. The Tories are anti-dissenter and they're slightly more sympathetic to Catholics, although only slightly. Out of that crisis, there's a sort of a kind of 4-year period where there is political chaos. And a lot of people think that England is about to fall into another civil war. There's this kind of fear of 41 again, 41 has come again. And eventually the monarchy is able to sort of close ranks and by making an alliance with the Tories, the monarchy is able to survive James isn't excluded from the throne. The Whigs are defeated, and you get this kind of period of repression known as the Tory reaction. But the outcome of that is that when Charles II does finally die in 1685, the monarchy is no longer this kind of all-encompassing, force for stability, which has united different factions, as it had to a point been in 1660. It's now much more factional. It is a monarchy which is aligned with one side of a very fractious political debate between Whigs and Tories. And the mistakes that James makes is that in order to cozy up to the Catholics, he alienates his natural supporters, the Tories, so that by 1688, both Tories and Whigs have decided that James needs to be checked. He needs to be challenged. And the way they do that is that seven of them write a letter inviting William of Orange, who's another grandson of Charles I, to come over to England and sort things out. Now, what does that mean at this point? Nobody quite knows. But when he comes over, it becomes clear that eventually he actually wants the throne to himself.
Because James's second wife delivers a boy, that means that Parliament must act, because there is an heir that would mean that the kingdom would remain Catholic.
To Protestants in England, it's a bit of a pain that the king is a kind of ardent Catholic, but because he's in his 50s, which at this point is quite old, they assume that his reign is not going to last very long, but that when he has a healthy son, then obviously that son will be brought up as a Catholic, so it becomes perpetual.
And William of Orange sets sail with 500 ships, and he lands on the 5th of November. Who's writing this drama, Jonathan?
Yes, and it's not even deliberate.
Yeah, I understand.
The initial plan had been to sail north, but the winds had stopped him. So he was, if you wanted to read a sort of, have a providential reading of the 17th century where it's all being orchestrated by God, then
you'd have a remember the 5th of November. James quite sensibly flees and doesn't make the mistake of standing trial, because as Jonathan writes, the parliamentarians had the same steel in their hands that they did in 1649. William and Mary are now the regents, the Protestant regents in London, and all is well in the kingdom by the sea until the next century. Jonathan Healy, the book is The Blazing World, A New History of Evolutionary England. This is where America came from, 1603 to 1689. I'm John Batch.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Hey guys, finding the perfect gift for the food lover in your life is easy, thanks to Goldbelly. Goldbelly ships America's most iconic foods straight from world-famous restaurants right to your door. So if you want to treat someone to Joe's Stone Crab from Miami, Franklin Barbecue from Texas, or desserts from famous foodies like Ina Garten or Martha Stewart, Goldbelly has you covered with free shipping anywhere in the country. Just go to goldbelly.com and for a limited time, get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's promo code GIFT.
Hey guys, have you heard of Goldbelly? It's this amazing site where they ship the most iconic, famous foods from restaurants across the country, anywhere, nationwide. I've never found a more perfect gift than food. Goldbelly ships Chicago deep dish pizza, New York bagels, Maine lobster rolls, and even Ina Garten's famous cakes. So, if you're looking for a gift for the food lover in your life, head to goldbelly.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's goldbelly.com, promo code GIFT.